morning, and welcome to Just One Thing, Simple Practices for Resilient Happiness by Dr. Rick Hansen. This is your volunteer programmer, Babs Felix, in Green Valley. Rick Hansen, PhD, is a psychologist and New York Times best-selling author. He's been invited to speak at NASA, Oxford, Stanford, Harvard, and meditation centers worldwide. His books are available in 28 languages and include Making Great Relationships, Hardwiring Happiness, Just One Thing, and Mother Nurture. His work has been featured on the BBC, CBS, NPR, and other major media. And now, Just One Thing. Are you getting rope burn? The practice. Cling less, love more. Why? As a rock climber and a parent, I know some physical kinds of clinging are good. Like too small holds or small hands. But clinging as a psychological state has a feeling of tension in it and drivenness, insistence, obsession, or compulsion. As experiences flow through the mind, seeing, hearing, planning, worrying, etc., they have what's called a hedonic tone of being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. It's natural to like what's pleasant and to dislike what's unpleasant. No problem so far. But then the mind takes it a step further, usually very quickly, and tries to grab what's pleasant, fight or flee from what's unpleasant, or prod what's neutral to get pleasant. This quality of grabbing, pushing, resisting, or pressing is the hallmark of clinging. Clinging is different from healthy desire, where we have wholesome values, aims, purposes, aspirations, and commitments, without being attached to the results. Yes, we could feel passionate about our goals and work hard for them. And the stakes could be high. For example, the health of a child, the success of a business, the fate of the Earth's climate. But when there's no clinging, we are deep down at peace with whatever happens, even if the surface layers of the mind are understandably disappointed, sad, or upset. Watch your mind, and you'll see it cling to lots of things. Remembering that pulling toward and pushing away are each a form of clinging. These include objects, viewpoints, routines, pleasures and pain, status, and even the sense of self, as when we take something personally. Recognize the costs of clinging. It's never relaxed and always has a sense of strain, ranging from subtly unpleasant to intensely uncomfortable. It sucks us into chasing problematic goals, like stressing out for success, getting rigid or argumentative with others, being hooked on food or drugs, or seeking rewards in relationships that will never come. It clenches and contracts rather than opens. And clinging today plants the seeds of clinging tomorrow. Most fundamentally, clinging puts us at odds with the nature of existence, which is always changing. The American Buddhist teacher Joseph Goldstein likens the stream of consciousness to a rope running through your hands. If you cling to any bit of it, you get rope burn. But if you let it run free, if you let experiences come and go, you feel peaceful and happy. Your mind and body open and love flows freely, the natural expression of the unclenched heart. How? As context. It's familiar advice, I'm sure, but do what you can to take care of your needs and those of others you care for. Pursue wholesome aims with energy and diligence. And keep the needle of your personal stress meter out of the red zone. Each of these steps will pull logs off the fire of clinging. Learn about clinging. Pick something specific, like a position about how something should be, and first, really, really cling to it. Insist in your mind that it must turn out a certain way. Notice what clinging feels like in your body and mind. Then, really try to relax the clinging. It's fine to wish for a certain result, but help yourself be at peace with whatever the result is by reminding yourself that you and others will likely still be fundamentally okay. Imagine whatever you've clung to as something small in a great space, such as a single stone in a vast plain seen from an airplane passing overhead. Disengage from overthinking, ruminating, or obsessing. Help your body relax and soften. Open your hands, let your mind open, and let go of clinging. Recognize the ease, the peace, the pleasure in releasing clinging, and let the sense of this sink into you, motivating your brain to cling less in the future. Set down your burdens. Try the practice just above with other things you've clung to. Start with easy things and work up. Remember, you can be fiercely, energetically committed to something without being attached to the result. Wake up from the spell. Investigate your experience of things you cling to, such as pleasant sensations or certain sights or ideas. Isolate any aspect of this experience and look closely at it in your mind. Ask yourself, is there real happiness in this? This sight or idea or sound, etc. I think you'll see the answer is always no. Stop looking for things to want. Notice how the mind continually looks for a reward to get, a problem to solve, or a threat to avoid. In other words, something else to cling to. A little of this is okay, but enough already. Bring your attention back to the present moment, to this activity, this conversation, this breath. This will pull you back into now, the only time that we are truly happy. Open your heart. As clinging recedes, let love move in. Look for small everyday expressions such as a kind word here and a gentle touch there. As you cling less, it's natural to lighten up, stay out of quarrels, have more compassion, put things in perspective, and forgive. As you let experiences flow through you without clinging to the past or future, you'll feel more fed by the richness inherent in the present, which makes the heart overflow. Love, in all its forms, large and small, crowds out clinging, which brings more love in a wonderfully positive cycle. You are listening to Just One Thing, Simple Practices for Resilient Happiness by Dr. Rick Hansen, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona in Flagstaff. And here's another Just One Thing. Find the facts. This was written November the 5th, 2016. It is so very helpful to see the truth both around you and inside you. Then you're more able to handle threats and fulfill opportunities, understand others, and make wise choices. Not finding the facts is like closing your eyes while walking on thin ice. Facts are important at all levels, whether about an individual, a relationship, or a country. I am going to focus here on America and comment on our politics, a departure from my usual focus on the individual, and feel free to listen no further. We had an election on November the 8th, but on every day, we are having a related election about an even more fundamental question. Facts, yes or no, valuing the truth. Where do we start? By claiming our right to know what is true. That's no small thing these days. When fire-hosed with information, it's hard to make sense of it, so people shrug, shake their heads, and tune out. Plus, most journalism has become a fact-free zone of horse race or theater criticism-style commentary and false equivalence between very different things to appear balanced. The truth is, many of us don't know what the truth is. Also, our beliefs are created and defended by loyalties to groups, grievances, and self-interest. As Upton Sinclair wrote, it is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it. The people hunker down with others who confirm their belief. So it's vital to challenge beliefs and to ground them in reality. As the saying goes, everyone is entitled to his own opinion, but not to his own facts. Personal disclosure. I should state my own loyalties. Growing up with loving but controlling parents, I value independence and self-reliance. I was a registered libertarian for many years and have read and may have read Atlas Shrugged more times than Paul Ryan. Like our founders, I'm for civil liberties, voting rights, obviously for more than white male property owners, and the rule of law. I'm deeply grateful to those who have served our country. I'm for competition on a fair field. Whether in grade school, Wall Street, Washington, or Moscow, I'm against bullies and cheats and hypocrites, and for children and the earth altogether. I've recently begun my 65th lap around the sun. Wow! Having lived through a lot of relevant history, I'd like to highlight some facts, both past and present. The human tribe. Let's start way back. Our current politics are grounded in the social structure of primate bands in which alphas gain and hold power and then use that power to control resources such as food and female reproduction. In more complex forms, we see the same thing in most human hunter-gatherer bands in which our ancestors lived for 95% of the past 200,000 years. With the advent of agriculture about 10,000 years ago, wealth and power became even more concentrated in the hands of a few, enabling them to support warriors to enforce their rule and priests to justify it. It's a very old story. At any point in human history, life has been particularly good for a few people and much worse for most people. In our own time, there is less starvation and disease, but the general fact remains true around the world. Great inequalities of wealth and power, along with the use of wealth to tilt the playing field, to gain more power, to tilt the field further, to gain even more wealth. The story is the same regardless of ideology. Consider communist Russia and China. I'm not saying that all those who have wealth and power gained it unfairly, but throughout history, we see again and again the self-serving use of wealth and power by the few to confuse and frighten the many. It's a classic pattern. Repeating the big lie, like burying the truth or hiding it in a fog bank of disinformation, whipping up fears about them attacking us, and exploiting our vulnerability as tribal beings to grievance, anger, and payback. Recent events. Sound familiar? It's happened a lot over the last 40 years in America and is now at a fever pitch in this election cycle. Understandably, many people are foggy or simply wrong about what's actually true. A lot because most media offer no factual context to the latest screaming headline. So here's a necessarily simplified summary of relevant facts. If you know them already, skip to the end. I've included a lot of links, but didn't have the time to reference every single point. Whatever my loyalties, facts are facts. See for yourself if these are true. In the 1960s, see a swing toward civil rights, environmentalism, feminism, gay rights, cultural and sexual freedom, and anti-war sentiment, all loosely associated with the Democratic Party. In 1968, Alabama Governor George Wallace runs as an independent on a platform of racial segregation and gets 14% of the vote. Richard Nixon promises law and order and wins narrowly. He and his vice president and top aides break multiple laws and eventually leave office for prison or disgrace. The Republican Party develops its Southern strategy to win over Wallace-type voters, also joining with fundamentalist groups seeking political influence over science in public schools, sexual behavior, and reproduction. As a religious person myself, I see a vital distinction between people of faith who live in accord with their own beliefs, and political fundamentalists who enforce those beliefs on others through the power of the state. The party becomes a coalition of wealthy elites, traditionalists, and political fundamentalists serving each other's interests. By Republican or Democrat, I mean the leadership and policy core of each party, not voters in general. Republican policy favors low regulation of business, low taxes on the wealthy, and a minimal social safety net. Democratic policy favors higher regulation of business, higher taxes on the wealthy, and less inequality, and a strong social safety net. Each party is allied with those whose interests it serves. The Republican Party with business and wealth, and the Democratic Party with labor and middle class. Since a large majority of Americans prefer the policies of the Democratic Party, the Republican Party must find other ways to win votes. It says that low taxes on the wealthy and low regulation of business will make prosperity trickle down for everyone, also eliminating the need for a safety net. It attacks government on moral grounds as takers who rob makers, and as deliberate and sustained policy makes government as weak as possible, starving the beast, so that people will get angry at it and become loyal to the Republican Party. Starting in 1980, Ronald Reagan and his Congress slash taxes on the wealthy and attack or undermine unions and other protections for blue-collar workers. Supply-side and trickle-down policies have little effect themselves. Running as fiscal conservatives, he and George H.W. Bush oversee a tripling of the national debt. The current situation. The Republican Party chooses Donald Trump to represent it as president. His businesses would compromise U.S. security, and some are backed by Russian oligarchs, and he's supported by Vladimir Putin, former head of the KGB, whose security forces are manipulating our election to pick Trump. His loyalty to Putin and denial of Russian cyber attacks are deeply alarming to the U.S. and European intelligence officials. He boasts of sexually assaulting women, and numerous women have reported him doing so. Many conservative leaders condemn Trump, including Mitt Romney, Colin Powell, and former President George H.W. Bush. He lies nearly continuously, which fries the circuits of the media, along with his authoritarian themes. His wealth is based on clever branding while cheating working people, ripping off investors, doing nothing for charity, and refusing to pay his share of taxes. The unemployment rate for white workers is currently 4.3%. The U.S. economy has gained 3.2 million jobs since Trump began running for president. The crime rate is approaching historic lows, and Trump's core supporters have a median income of over $70,000. White male resentment and nationalism is their primary fuel, not economic anxiety or the effects of global trade turbocharging by alt-right and conservative media. The Democratic Party chooses Hillary Clinton, a centrist liberal who has become the most thoroughly scrutinized and thus effectively transparent presidential candidate in our history. She's been attacked steadily for 35 years, reaching back to charges that she wasn't feminine enough as the governor's wife in Arkansas. And what's the worst that's been actually found? Let's see, she stood by her husband when he was accused of adultery and wasn't friendly toward the women he cheated on. Dozens of State Department employees had been killed during Bush's two terms. Republican lawmakers refused to fund heightened security for U.S. embassies and consulates when Clinton was Secretary of State, and internal requests for more security at our diplomatic compound in Benghazi, Libya, were turned down by upper management in the State Department, not Clinton herself. Ask the ancient question that cuts through the words and deeds. Who benefits? Votes have effects. At bottom, do you want your vote to support the policies of a coalition of rich elites, political fundamentalists, and bigoted nationalists? I don't. May you and I and everyone else keep finding the facts and learning from them for our own sake and that of others. You've been listening to Just One Thing, Simple Practices for Resilient Happiness by Dr. Rick Hansen, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona in Flagstaff. This is your volunteer programmer, Babs Felix, in Parks. Thank you so much for listening today, and I hope that you have a wonderful rest of your day. And now, stay tuned for more interesting programming coming to you from Sun Sounds of Arizona.